Welcome to Counting the Earth from the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology. I'm Alice Hope.
And I'm Sue Nelson. Now, as you can hear, we're definitely not in the studio. We're on location again, this time at a yearly event considered a great British institution, the RHS Chelsea Flower Show. Now, it's pretty noisy. We've got helicopters overhead, there's choirs, but most of all, it's people watching, I think, as well as the flowers. Everyone is dressed to impress. Across us here, there's an amazingly beautiful stand of peonies, all sorts of shades of pink, very frilly. Then we've got some frothy carnations over there. And on the stand here, the UKCEH one, well, it's more my cup of tea. Foxgloves, wildflowers, gorgeous.
We're here because this year, as Sue just said, UKCH has an exhibit at the show, focusing on the importance of gardens for wildlife, whatever their size. I learned, putting the exhibit together, Sue, that UK gardens collectively form more green space than all our national nature reserves combined, accounting for 9,600 square kilometres of UK land.
I don't know which I'm more impressed by, that number or the fact that you've won a silver at the Chelsea Flower Show.
We won a silver at the judging, which is an amazing achievement. So well done to all of the team that put the garden together. We're very, very excited.
So this is why this 9,600 is our headline number. Not because you got a medal, but because of that wonderful statistic.
Yes, absolutely. And this highlights the power of gardens as these vital mini ecosystems that we can all help create.
Well, I don't think my garden will ever win any awards, but it's definitely a mini ecosystem. We've got a beech hedge, which the birds love, and since No Mow May often morphs into Just Don't Bother June in our case, at least we've got plenty of wildflowers for bees and insects.
Well, that is very, very good to hear, because the ambition of our exhibit is to help people appreciate how they can use their plant choices to make their gardens look beautiful whilst also shaping a thriving ecosystem and support biodiversity through pollinator-friendly and drought-tolerant planting. And we want to show how the public can help scientists understand these spaces better through becoming citizen scientists while also improving their own well-being at the same time.
On the UKCEH stand and in this podcast, we're finding out about the surprising array of wildlife that's tucked into all corners of your garden. And we're exploring the ingenious new ways scientists are developing to record all that life in our green spaces. Creatures like these.
I wouldn't have thought that insects in the soil could be that loud. I mean, one of those almost sounded like those instruments you get with the ridges on that you had in primary school that you'd kind of put a stick on that makes that
like
sort
a ribbit, ribbit, ribbit.
Like a frog noise. Exactly. I would have thought that was a frog, not
for
something
me,
living in the soil.
They didn't sound like animals at all. I thought it was static and somebody rustling a paper bag. So we really need to find out what these are. And on the stand with us today is Alicia Duffy, a data scientist at UKCH. Alicia, put us out of our misery. What on earth did we just hear?
The first one was an earthworm as it moves through the soil. The second was a beetle as it tippy-taps across the top. And then the third one was ants, actually, as they head towards their burrow.
That's unbelievable. I never would have guessed this.
And so the first one was the earthworm sort of scrunching its body together. We did a previous episode all about earthworms, and some of them burrow really deep underground. So how did you manage to get these recordings?
Soil acoustics is actually a really new area of science. The team here at UKCEH are really trying to pioneer the technology in this space, and our team have actually built a custom recorder for the soil acoustics. So it's made up of a Zoom recorder and a contact microphone that you stick inside the soil and you're able to record these sounds.
So this is definitely a mix of off the shelf and not quite sort of customized as well. Now I'm looking down at your lovely display of wildflowers and I can see a few bits of tech and equipment, but nothing that I would guess was a soil acoustic recorder. Which one is it?
Here.
Oh, that's tiny.
The part that's actually doing the recording is this.
I mean, that's not much bigger than a 50 pence piece, a flat, almost coin-like structure. And then it's got a needle in it which is longer than my middle finger, and then that, gosh, that's like a probe, like you would put in a turkey to test it was done, really, wouldn't you? So you then pop that in and that records it.
It actually picks up the vibration of these creatures inside the soil, and that is what is being translated into the sound.
We've got a tiny little pond here with some lovely white stones, and I can see another recorder with an incredibly long cable. What is it that we're recording with that?
So this is our freshwater acoustics recorder, and you'll actually be surprised to learn that your garden ponds at home have a cacophony of sounds inside them. There's lots of different creatures we can find inside our fresh water, like water divers. You can even hear snails moving across different surfaces. And if you're lucky enough, your garden might be home to frogs or a newt, all of which make lots of sound. But most of the time we miss it because it's underwater.
Shall we hear a little bit of what that sounds like?
So do these recordings give you an idea of exactly what you've got either in the soil or in the water?
They're definitely working towards that. This is quite a pioneering piece of research, both for freshwater acoustics and for soil acoustics. But what we do with these recordings is we take them away and we run them through AI algorithms, which are able to identify unique things inside the sounds. And we're working with scientists across the globe to create catalogues, in essence, of what these sounds actually are, both for the soils and for fresh water.
You mentioned you've been taking recordings in ponds, but the cable of this is incredibly long for a pond. I don't know anyone who has a pond that deep. Why is the cable so long?
So this particular device was actually made for one of our projects that we are developing up in the northern part of the UK, looking at Arctic char. And the idea behind the system was we needed something that you could throw into a lake and leave it there to record automatically for a number of months, which is why we had to custom design this type of machine, because that isn't readily available at the moment.
I've got the Merlin app on my phone, and it's amazing how it can pick out individual bird species, even if you're hearing a mix of different sounds. I presume AI is making these things possible, and that's something you're looking into as well?
AI is really the driver behind a lot of these systems, or the usability of these systems, not only for the freshwater acoustics and also for the soils, but also for a device we're going to see later. AI is what we use to do the identifications. And not only are scientists training these AI systems, but we also rely heavily on citizen science to be able to populate and train these models and these systems in the background. So the research is actually really done on the back of a lot of citizen science and the efforts that people contribute. So even if you go out to your garden and you're recording a bird, it's likely that the data you've recorded has gone in to train these systems. So apps and platforms like Merlin rely very heavily on the contributions of everyday people.
Well, there's one more bit of equipment here that we've not discussed yet. It almost looks like a sort of iPad device, vertical, stuck there, and it says Leppy Sense. I've heard this being referred to as a moth photo booth, which is fabulous. So you've got to explain this one to us and how it works.
So the Leppy Sense system is taking images. So it takes snapshots. It uses three different types of light, so UV, white light, and blue light, to attract nocturnal insects. And they land on the board and then have their photo taken, and then they can fly away.
Sorry, it's just so funny. Now, whereabouts, show me where this would land, because we've got that sort of vertical bit that sticks up at 90 degrees to the ground. So a moth would land on there, and at the end, almost like if you go into a photo booth with your mate, it takes a photo. So that triggers something, a movement triggers the photo. And then where do these pictures go? I'm assuming some of them, like in an ordinary photo booth, you're a bit blurred, you've got your profile, you're, you know, making a funny expression, it's not quite right. How do you tell what moth is what?
So the moths land on this whiteboard here is the idea, and the images can either be motion triggered or taken on a schedule, so a 10-minute scheduling.
Gotcha.
And then this unit here is the actual camera that takes their photos. Yes, you do end up with some individuals in a photo being blurred, but actually we find that lots of nocturnal insects will stay and settle on the boards. So what we end up with is hundreds of photos of particular individuals who've decided that this is where I'm staying for the entire night.
It's like the Kim Kardashian of moths.
Yes. We have had some directly land on the actual camera before, and all you get is their face and not the board at all, which is quite funny. You can end up with thousands of images per night. Pictures from this system are then fed into a particular AI process that we have developed, and it uses the AI algorithms to not only identify the individuals down to species level, but we can also track their movements in time. So as I said, the ones that stay on the board, we can follow them too. So they're not double counted, despite their desire to be.
That's absolutely amazing, just thinking about all of those moths, and we've got a video running on the stand where you can watch all of the insects moving around. The fact that we can use AI to help us understand the natural world is just incredible, and thank you so much, Alicia, for explaining it to us. There is so much life out there, even if you have a garden the size of a postage stamp, but clearly most of us don't have access to such fancy equipment. Luckily, there are much simpler ways for the public to engage with the wildlife, and we have some here.
There's even a good old-fashioned butterfly net.
Never goes out of fashion and still used very regularly by researchers. For a bit of a bigger outlay with some impressive DIY skills, you can set up a light trap overnight and harmlessly catch some of the 2,500 moth species found in the UK, from the scarlet cinnabar moth and the sulphurous brimstone to maybe even the huge dead's head hawk moth that has a wingspan of 120 millimeters. There are lots of ID charts to be found online that will help you identify what you found.
I've got a little bit of FOMO with all these technological devices, because I would really like one of those moth photo booths, but the closest I've had to any technology, and it's not technology at all, is a bee hotel, which somebody bought me, which is very simple, made of little different sized hollow bamboo tubes, but they are pretty good. They do attract solitary bees, mason bees, and you can watch them go in and out, see them fill the ends up when they're laying their eggs, and you really start to recognize the different types of bees that there are. And it's quite zen-like, because there are about 250 types of solitary bees, 24 types of bumblebees, and if you just chill out, watch them, you actually start to see which one's which.
There is actually research showing the well-being benefits of engaging with nature, and that's something our next guest is a bit of an expert in. Dr. Michael Pocock is an ecologist at UKCH, and he has a special interest in people's interactions with nature and the benefits of taking part in citizen science initiatives. Lovely to have you on the podcast, Michael. What does your research tell us about the benefits of spending time in and with nature and getting involved with citizen science projects?
We've particularly been looking at those benefits that people get from taking part in citizen science. And so people going out in their gardens or in other places, making records of wildlife, can engage with nature in different ways. And so we did some research comparing a sort of mindful engagement with nature, people out chilling in their gardens, looking at different species, compared to citizen science. And what we found was that both have really good benefits on people's well-being and people's nature connectedness.
So this could be actually just sitting down, reading, just being in your garden, looking and being surrounded by flowers, or being more active, like you said, a citizen scientist actually maybe using an app of some sort to help scientists like yourself.
Yeah, we did that comparison, people spending 10 minutes in nature. And the thing is that who gives themselves 10 minutes simply to stop? And yet we know physiologists tell us that spending 10 minutes engaging with nature does something to you. It reduces stress hormones and it relaxes you. And so we specifically sought to look, does citizen science provide those benefits as well? And the answer was, yes, it does. So actively engaging with nature by giving yourself that permission to spend 10 minutes doing a pollinator count or counting butterflies in your garden has all of those benefits. And people actually do give themselves the permission because they're doing the data collection for someone else as well. The data are going somewhere. So actually those records are going to be in our databases being used for research and analysis for decades, if not hundreds of years to come. So all in all, it's a really vital thing.
Well, that makes perfect sense, actually, because there's also been research on how doing charitable works aids your mental health. So it totally fits in then. because you are effectively doing charity work with citizen science, aren't you?
We looked at this in terms of what psychologists call the pathways to nature connectedness. And actually, citizen science activates all of those. So it's about using your senses and finding meaning in nature. But also it activates really strongly this sense of caring for nature. So yes, of course, when you're gardening with nature in mind, you're caring for nature. But actually going out, doing the science, making those records as well, is an expression of care. And it leads on to, as I said, the benefits for greater well-being, greater nature connectedness, and also what we found in our research, people's intention for pro-environmental behaviours, the sorts of things which go on to benefit nature and the environment more generally.
We made a whole podcast episode about pollinators nearly 2 years ago now, featuring the Royal Horticultural Society. And in it, we explained how to do a FIT count, a flower insect timed count, and use the app. If you haven't heard that episode yet, do go back and listen. And it was a fascinating insight into things like the importance of flower choice for different pollinating insects. But there are many other nature-based citizen science apps out there, and they are hugely popular. iRecord and related websites have had over 35 million wildlife records submitted by members of the public since 2010. So Michael, talk us through some of the tools that people can use to participate with these projects, and how do they differ? How do we pick between them?
We've got these FIT counts, flower insect timed counts, where people can go in the countryside or in their gardens, spend 10 minutes counting the different types of insects coming along to a patch of flowers. And so those are the sorts of things that people can do anywhere. There's things like iRecord butterflies, where people can record any butterflies that they see, but also, once again, they can do timed counts. These timed counts are particularly valuable for science. But iRecord, people can make records, they can photograph any insect or any other wildlife or plants that they see. It's got inbuilt AI, so it supports people with the identification. And so all of these ways are ways in which people can make genuine contributions to science by submitting these data.
I'd seen that there's even one called iRecord Grasshoppers, which uses sounds to identify the individual grasshoppers. I mean, that's quite fun.
And that's the wonderful thing about using new technologies with citizen science, that we can access so many different ways. And in the iRecord Grasshoppers app, there are sound files which are available, so you can play the sound files rather than trying to identify these things hopping through the undergrowth in your garden. You just have to listen.
Our headline figure for this episode is celebrating the 9,600 square kilometres of land in the UK given over to people's gardens. Do you think people would be surprised at the abundance of life that can be found in their own green spaces if they take the time to actually stop and look?
Yes, there was one person who spent 3 decades, I think it was, studying different species within a single, fairly ordinary garden and identified many thousand different species of insects. All these different obscure groups, from the moths, the butterflies, the insects that we notice, right down to tiny little parasitic wasps, which are fractions of a millimetre long. So really exploring this huge diversity of wildlife, which is found in any garden, no matter how big or small.
And you can also do those little bees I was mentioning about, those solitary bees that don't just like the little hotels, some of them burrow in the ground as well.
I think that's the wonderful thing about nature, that there are so many different ways in which we can provide benefits to nature. Within our gardens, there are different things that we can do. So leaving areas of bare grounds where you see the bees nesting, as you say, like those little volcanoes of earth, as they're burying in the ground. Such an incredible variety.
You do seem very zen-like, I must admit. You seem very sort of calm and relaxed. So I'm assuming it definitely works for you, as obviously it does for the public. Dr. Michael Pocock, thank you very much for joining us. Michael mentioned a variety of citizen science apps there, from the FIT Count app to iRecord. And this summer, there's an extra push on studying the wildlife visiting our gardens through the Big British Garden Survey. As well as submitting observations, participants are asked to complete a survey about their gardens so that any sightings have greater context. And this will help scientists better understand the role that gardens play in providing space and resources for wildlife.
The Big British Garden Survey is being run by the National Garden Scheme, with UKCEH scientists designing the survey and managing and summarising the data collected. So we've taken a wander out onto the main avenue to their exhibit to meet their chief executive, Dr. Richard Claxton. Before we get onto the survey itself, tell us briefly what the National Garden Scheme does.
We are a kind of national institution, really. We're a charity that was founded 99 years ago to raise money for district nursing in particular, and that happens through gardens that open. So in 1927, 600 gardens opened. They were mainly stately homes back then, and they charged a shilling each to let people in, and they raised £8,000. Last year, £78 million later, we raised £4.5 million through 600,000 garden visits to 3,500 gardens. And we still give all the money to healthcare and nursing beneficiaries or to support gardeners and garden and health projects.
Now, I mentioned a couple of apps. They're already hugely popular. Alice and I have got several of them. What difference will it make to scientists if they have additional facts about the garden to go into what's being recorded by an app?
From a scientific point of view, it's going to contextualise the data. If they're getting extra information about the kinds of garden, then that will allow them to be able to map better the biodiversity and the wildlife that they find.
Can you give us an example of that in terms of the context? Are you talking about soil, the location?
The types of soil, the location in terms of, is it way down in the south of the country or the southwest, where the entomology that you'll find, the bug life and so on that you'll find, might be quite different to in the extreme north. Whether or not there's water, we're hearing a water feature in the background now. That makes a huge difference to the wildlife in the garden.
We tend to see a lot of records of bees and butterflies, those more, I suppose, charismatic insects, but a lot less of the creepy crawlies, your earwigs, your woodlice, the things that probably have a perception of being a bit brown and boring. What's the value of those insects to gardens, and why is it important for people to log those sightings as well?
In a word, soil is the answer. And in soil, the key to life on Earth exists, really, in terms of if you've got that many invertebrates, if you've got woodlice, if you've got tiny little beetles and spiders, then they are a sign of a thriving soil system. And in any teaspoon of soil, we know that there are a billion bacteria, and some of those bacteria are beneficial to our health, not just the health of the garden and the health of the ecosystem. So it's about joining the dots. And yes, everyone loves a butterfly, and they're almost like a metaphor for beauty in the garden. But butterflies come from caterpillars, which aren't so attractive often, and everything in the food chain is related to each other as well. So it's all about healthy systems and healthy networks in a semi-wild space.
So Richard, how would you suggest people go about this? Do they just take photographs ad hoc whenever they go into the garden, or is it a bit more structured?
No, taking a snap of something when you see it is absolutely fine. There are three apps. One is the iRecord, which is I record anything as and when I see it. I see a butterfly or I see a bumblebee, I can record that on the app. The second one is I record butterflies. That's doing a count of butterflies that you see anywhere in your garden. And the third one is the fit count. You look at a group of flowers in your garden, you need to count the number of pollinating insects that you can see on them at any one time. And the idea, ideally, you'd kind of go back and reassess this every couple of weeks. But you don't have to be strict with yourself about that. It really doesn't matter if it's just as and when. The more data they gather over a longer period of time, the more meaningful that data becomes.
Richard Claxton, thank you very much for speaking to us and for all those useful tips.
Throughout this episode, we've been focusing on the people power needed to understand the wildlife in our gardens, from the Big British Garden Survey to the citizen science recording apps. But we also asked two of our guests for their tips on how to attract more wildlife into our own gardens.
One of the great things about actions for bringing wildlife into your garden is that you don't need to turn your garden into a complete rambling wilderness. What's become really popular over the past few years is No Mow May, where people have left areas of their lawn unmown for that period of time, allowing the wildflowers to come through, which provides these amazing sources of pollen and nectar for bees and hoverflies and other insects, and leaving those little corners of slightly unmanaged areas or small log piles, things like that, are absolutely fantastic for an incredible range of insects and mammals as well. It's about providing food and shelter for a really wide range of insects. So providing flowers throughout the year, as gardeners love to do, makes it really accessible for a really wide range of pollinators, from things like the early flowering heathers for queen bees, right through to ivy at the very end of the season. In terms of choosing plants, I would definitely choose particularly those that have got fairly simple open flower structures. Are absolutely fantastic for the pollinators, much better than those which are a double or very ornamental varieties. One of the other things that you can do is plant native trees, plant native hedging as well. These are fantastic. They provide insect food plants, so for caterpillars and other things to feed on the leaves. Many of them have got flowers, they produce berries, and great homes for birds, other wildlife to live in.
I'd start off by saying soil again. Soil health is so important to the biodiversity in your garden, and in particular using an organic mulch that ideally made yourself. So garden compost, leaf mould, lawn cuttings, and it will be teeming with bacterial life and microorganisms. And if you put that on the soil, the earthworms will help digest it, and then the whole thing breaks down into a virtuous circle that will massively improve your soil health, as well as bringing more insects in to eat those microorganisms and so on. Then the insects get eaten by the birds and the food chain is propagated that way. And the side effect of having healthy soil is you get great looking plants. Two is water. Water is a game changer for a garden. So a pond or a water feature that is at ground level, so that things like hedgehogs can come in, toads, newts can get in and out of it. So you'll find that you suddenly have less in the way of slugs eating your plants as well if you do that. But actually you'll find that birds go there, insects, bees, wasps all need water. So a water supply in your garden allows everything to survive better.
Well, sadly for us, our time at the RHS Chelsea Flower Show is almost up, but it's been great fun.
I think my favourite thing that we've seen has been the technology. I loved hearing that earthworm squelching through the soil. I thought that was brilliant.
For me, it's the Kardashians. It's those moths that love the selfie booth. And then seeing it here on the stand, the screen at the top where you could actually see the AI identify the moths, that blew me away. I just thought that was absolutely fantastic.
And where better than the RHS Chelsea Flower Show, the temple of UK horticulture that it is, to celebrate the contributions our gardens can make to the natural world. I read a really shocking figure recently that we've seen a 70% reduction in wildlife populations since 1970. It's easy to think that your individual garden doesn't have much of an impact, but whether it's a balcony planter, an allotment, or a back lawn, it's part of a much bigger living dynamic system. Let's recap on our headline figure for today. 9,600 square kilometres of land in the UK is made up of people's gardens. Taken together, that makes a huge contribution to supporting biodiversity in the UK. According to the Royal Horticultural Society, gardens support around half of all UK birds, mammals, butterflies, reptiles, and amphibians. And that is just staggering.
Now, as you know, Alice, I'm a big fan of nature apps. When we've done podcasts out in fields before, I've been a nightmare because I stop to use it and take a picture. But at the heart of the message of this podcast is the value of putting nature apps to work for citizen science. When people record wildlife sightings, count insects, or share acoustic data, millions of small contributions build a powerful national evidence base, shape conservation policy, guide government action, and help protect biodiversity across the UK.
And don't overlook those unsung heroes either. The earwigs, the spiders, the moths. Every species has a role, be it as pest controllers, pollinators, or just food for organisms higher up the food chain. It's a connected community that flourishes in nature-friendly gardens.
Thank you for joining us today for Counting the Earth at the RHS Chelsea Flower Show in London. We hope you enjoy this episode, and please join us again for another look at nature through numbers.